Still, good morning. May it please the court, Eric Pills for Petitioner Maryland Transit Administration. With me at council table today is Byron Smith, Assistant Attorney General and Deputy Counsel of the Maryland Transit Administration. We're here today, Your Honors, with the decision of the Surface Transportation Board rejecting the statements of willingness to accept financial responsibility agreed to between MTA, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. The STB rejected the proposed SWAFRs because they didn't comply precisely with the terms of the SWAFR set forth in the regulation. The STB claimed that it had ministerial obligation to only approve the form SWAFR in the regulation and not to take into consideration the sovereign immunities of Maryland and Delaware in connection with the indemnity provision of the SWAFRs?
I can tell you the sovereign immunities is pretty shallow. You don't have to follow this process. It's a voluntary process, and if you want to be available, it's like the spending clause cases. But if you want to go ahead and argue that, I can tell you I didn't find anything that appealed to the notion that the federal government's impinging on the sovereignty of the state of Maryland or Delaware.
Well, I will give it a try, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think the cases, certainly Atascadero, Florida Prepaid, this court's decision, Reinhardt, make it very clear that just because a program is voluntary, and this isn't a spending clause program, this is a Commerce Clause regulation program.
It's an accommodation. It's a gift. Basically, they're using the Federal Supremacy Clause to allow you to take a railroad right-of-way and convert it into something else.
But the key to all of those cases is that the waiver has to be voluntary.
Well, you don't have to go into it.
But you have to go into it knowingly, and that is the key. And the cases make it very clear that it has to be an explicit and express, a explicit emphatic statement requiring waiver as a condition.
They're not requiring anything. They're telling you it's a condition.
But they say
in order to make that conversion, you have to be able to demonstrate that you have fully assumed responsibility in other things, the word fully.
And your
argument is, we can't assume fully because we have certain sovereign immunities. Well, then, basically, you can't do it.
Well, but the court, I mean, an example of, just to show the contrast between the kind of provisions that have been found to be a waiver and those that haven't. In the, quoted in the Reinhardt case, this is from Constantine B. Rectors v. Visitors of George Mason University, a state shall not be immune under the 11th Amendment of the Constitution from suit in federal court for violation of certain provisions of the Civil Rights Act. Very explicit, precise statement that there's a waiver. When you agree to this, you're agreeing to the waiver, as opposed to the more generic sue and be sued language, which is not construed to be a waiver, or the language
I'm
in the...
I'm telling you to waive. You can waive if you wish,
but
the point is you're asking, you're going in and with a hat in hand, and you're basically asking under regulations, we want to take advantage of the railroad right-of-way and have it extended and repurposed, so to speak, for a new use. Now, you don't have to do that, but if one of the conditions of doing it is you put up 16 red flags on the east side of the right-of-way, it seems to me if you want to have that right-of-way, you've got to put up the 16 red flags.
And I can only point you again, Your Honor, to the court's decision in Reinhardt. A state does not waive its sovereign immunity through its mere receipt of federal funds or participation in federal program. Instead, Congress
If the federal funds are given to you with a condition that you satisfy it,
but
then you don't have to accept them if you don't want the condition.
But I think the key here, Your Honor, first of all, is that there are no federal funds given to
you. I understand, but they're giving you an authority to do something. They're giving you a benefit, a gift, a privilege. And you don't have to take it. You don't have to apply for it. You're not forced to do anything. What they're doing is the same as a condition. If you want it, and they really don't, I'm not sure you even have to waive sovereign immunity, or maybe you do, but...
Well, even the STB agrees that we would.
There's a couple of problems with the form that you use that makes the application conditional. Now, maybe you have some answers to it, but of course, one is it's dependent on future appropriations, and the other is dependent on governmental immunity, subject to governmental immunity. And the the statute and the agent federal people say, we need a full assumption of liability to make this work. And that's, if you can't satisfy it, so be it. You don't have to. You don't have to do anything in this process.
And the cases from this court and the Supreme Court have made clear over and over again that even in that precise situation where it's a voluntary program that anyone could otherwise participate in, states cannot be obligated or required to waive their sovereign immunity without an explicit statement that's what they're doing.
That means they haven't waived it without an explicit statement. But that's quite different because it has to be explicit. But that's quite different from a condition imposed in connection with a benefit provided by the federal government.
But what the cases are saying is that Congress has to make that condition explicit, so that the statement...
They basically say an applicant has to fully answer for the liability.
And that's no different than, for example, in the Huang case, the sue or be sued kind of language, or in the Bell Atlantic case, the PUC is
I don't think you're even in the same pew with these cases. I mean, there's a lot of case law about waivers of sovereign immunity, and I can tell you, I think we're very sensitive to protecting the sovereign immunities of a state. There's no question about it. The federal government does not impose that lightly and can't under the Constitution. But this is a program, a voluntary program, that you want to convert a federally authorized railroad right-of-way into something else. And the federal government says, if you want to do that, fine. But if you're going to do that, whoever does it has to assume the liabilities.
First, I'm not sure that you characterized the program correctly, and I do think that's important. MTA owns the property and owns the line. And in order to preserve the corridor...
They own the right-of-way, right? Are there outright grants or these leases?
It's a mix of easement and outright, but they own the easement.
Right.
They own the right to operate the rail over the line. And the purpose of the Trails Act is twofold. One, to promote the creation of recreational trails, but secondly, to preserve that corridor intact for the future resumption of rail service if any operator should want to do so. So there's a benefit working both ways. And the question is, to get to the other point, it isn't at all clear that it requires a waiver of sovereign immunity. The STB has construed the statute to preserve the sovereign immunity of trail sponsors for direct claims against themselves. So there's nothing necessary about the language in this Trails Act that mandates the waiver of sovereign immunity. And that's exactly the issue.
What's it say that the applicant, the sponsor, must be prepared to assume full responsibility for any legal liability arising out of such transfer or use?
That's exactly what the statute says.
It's pretty clear, isn't it?
Well, legal liability. The STB has already construed that to not require you to assume claims over which the state would have sovereign immunity. The trail sponsor directs claims. Why should it be any different for claims under the indemnity provision? And as you suggested earlier, it's not that there's not liability, it's that it's subject to the ability to pay. That's really no different than the obligation that any indemnity, assumes when they enter into an indemnity agreement.
Except a claimant under the requirements of the statute would be able to obtain a response for a liability claim, whereas under your proposed takeover, there may be sovereign immunity. There may not be any right.
The
state may choose not to waive any. And if the state has chosen not to waive any, there's no liability, assumption.
I think at the end of the day, any payment from the government is always subject to an appropriation by the legislature, and you could always be left in a position where your claim goes...
That's even more speculative, isn't it, with the governments the way they are these days?
Certainly, we've learned to think that anything is possible. However,
you create a trust fund, and for the purpose of acquiring or converting, and have the appropriations precede the process.
Well, that would necessarily, you don't know what the claim would be because it's an indemnity provision. You can't fund it. You always have the same problem. You're either overfunding or underfunding, and you're always subject to the same problem. And I think that really is the fundamental issue here. Again, that the STB first is construing this inconsistently because they don't impose anything like those requirements on private trail sponsors. There's no requirement of posting a bond, approving security. They accept the assumption by the railroad, that if they've negotiated an agreement...
Why can't you put up insurance?
We could, but that would pose the same problem because how much insurance is enough? Have you covered it? And who evaluates it? The STB's position here is we don't have to look at anything. You either sign the SWAFR, the form SWAFR, or not, and that's all. We're not going to evaluate the adequacy of insurance.
We start with the proposition of whether your submissions complied with the statute and the reg. And the statute says you have to assume full responsibility. And the question is, did your forms assume full responsibility?
And our position is they did. It says so expressly, we assume full financial responsibility for all legal liability. And then we add the subject to the availability of funds provision. And our position is that we are on the hook, morally if not legally, for the full amount of whatever indemnity may come forward. But...
are you legally? If you're immune, you're not legally.
The issue is simply that at the end of the day, no, we could not be compelled to actually cut the check absent an appropriation of funds.
Wouldn't it be a trial? Wouldn't it be a judgment?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor, as to whether there is any opportunity for a declaratory judgment or something like that. But no, you could not get an enforceable judgment on that claim. But it's equally speculative to say that the state won't honor that obligation and the legislature won't appropriate those funds, as it is to say that a private trail sponsor will live up to its obligations and will, at the end of the day, have the funds on hand to satisfy that obligation. The other point, as my initial time is running out, is that even apart from the sovereign immunity decisions, the STB's decision is unreasonable by any measure of statutory construction. Rather than fulfill the congressional obligation to encourage participation by trail sponsors, including public trail sponsors, the STB is discouraging participation by refusing to make any acknowledgement of the unique circumstances here or in general. For example, not only do you have agreements between two sovereigns, Maryland and Delaware, the agreement also is between two branches of Maryland. It's an intramural dispute. Shouldn't those parties be able to allocate the risk appropriately between themselves, which is different than the normal situation? STB refused to even consider that, even though it's willing to consider that when a railroad negotiates with a private trail sponsor, that it presumes that the trail sponsor is qualified and will perform its obligations. So, you end up with a situation here where the STB is willing to say, we'd rather there be no trail at all, no preservation of the right-of-way, than to make any attempt to make any accommodation to encourage, much less allow, the trail sponsors in this case to participate.
Could a holder, Baltimore or Ohio Railroad, convert a railroad to a trail with it being the sponsor? In other words, you're raising the notion that the state is dealing with itself, and I'm not sure the statute envisions somebody converting his own interest. It really requires a sale or assignment.
It's not a sale or assignment. It's a trail use agreement. With a sponsor. I don't know the answer to that question, Ron.
Well, it may be an interesting question because... You make an equitably defined point that you're dealing with yourself. You have two agencies of the Maryland government. Why do you need to identify each other? The liability issue is probably broader than that, though. It probably protects the use by public and everybody else. So that I can see an interest in making sure the liability is taken care of.
Well, there was no objection.
The indemnity, I'm not sure, but the statute seems to require it.
Well, I think the point here is that the STB recognizes that a railroad can make an assessment of the acceptability of the risk of non-performance by a private trail sponsor. And yet in this case, where you're dealing with two branches or two departments of the same government, where you're making essentially an internal allocation of risk, that it won't even consider that claiming this ministerial duty, which isn't found in the language of the statute itself. I think that's the fundamental problem. At least give some consideration to the magnitude of the risk, the reasonableness of the risk, and whether there are any interests that the STB and the federal government really are concerned about implicated here. The consequence may be no trail and no preservation of the right-of-way, which are Congress's express objectives. And is it reasonable to construe a statute in a way that undermines those express objections without even giving consideration to whether it's necessary to go as far as they have?
The Trails Act itself talks about, envisions a transfer or conveyance for interim use.
And that's the trail use agreement.
Well, the statute says that.
Yes, and I think it's termed in terms of a...
Well, that's right. But so the question is, would the statute envision the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad just going in and saying, we're going to do it, be our sponsor ourselves, in which case you don't have to reach any agreement?
I don't know the answer. I would imagine, like, as in this case, where you have two, if I can use the term loosely, corporate subsidiaries of the state of Maryland contracting with each other, which is acceptable to the state of Maryland, and no objection was raised by the STB. I assume that if the Baltimore and Ohio, or I think that was the railroad you mentioned, had a special purpose entity or two subsidiaries dealing with each other, that might be acceptable as well.
Then you'd have to still then have the indemnity and the protection, right?
But in that case, the STB is willing to presume that the trail sponsor will perform its obligations. And I keep coming back to that because that's the key here. It's not that the trail sponsors here are not willing to indemnify. It's they are legally incapable of making the promise that they will
pay. Why don't you go to our senators and get a special bill or get this amended? It seems to me your purpose in this case is really quite noble, and it's really very much in the interest of the people to have something like this accommodated. But you also have a statute that has its restrictions. And
well,
it seems to me, when it comes to having governments own railroad rights, which is this case, to have the government have another agency become a sponsor, there have got to be some special rules, it seems to me. But the statute doesn't make exceptions for it.
Well, and in a sense, that's the point. First of all, the STB is charged with construing the statute in a way that would encourage participation. And I think having to go and get a special bill passed through legislature every time you want to go into one of these trails.
The statute ought to be changed fundamentally. I mean, I don't think there'd be much opposition because it's such a benign purpose.
Well, if it's not a breach of some code, maybe we can hire you as a lobbyist. I think it would impose... it's a substantial burden that hardly encourages.
Offer,
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You've got to make a good offer.
I think that is exactly the kind of hoops that the decision would force states to go through, which impose substantial barriers to becoming trail sponsorship, rather than at least trying to find a way to accommodate the interests in a way that respects both state sovereignty as well as the interests of set forth in the Trails Act. There was none of that here, just the blanket, you didn't sign the form, we're not going to...
Are you aware of any other states or state interests that have gone through this process and converted to trails?
Well, we relied below on three decisions before the board where state sponsors did submit a modified SWAFR that was accepted by the board and its staff without challenge. Now, there is examples, as the STB has cited, where they weren't accepted, but... It was our understanding when we began this process that allowing for these exceptions was permitted under board procedures, and which is why we're here.
I was going to say, but in fact, the original sponsoring organizations that began this process were apparently willing to sign the forms without condition or amendment. It was only after these subsequent entities came on board that this fight all began with respect to these changes. Isn't that right?
You mean in this particular case?
Right.
I don't recall, Your Honor, if the original proposed sponsors were willing to do this without the qualifications. I think the fact
that's my recollection of the record. But even so, I mean, I guess just Niemeyer's point is well taken. There have been a number of state entities, other jurisdictions, that presumably have the same sovereign immunity concerns as Maryland, but signed without condition.
Well, I don't know. I haven't done a survey of all the laws. The fact is that both Maryland and Delaware do take a different approach. Take the position that the agencies are prohibited. It would be ultra vires for them to enter into this kind of unqualified indemnity agreement.
Well, the state could waive, couldn't it? The state could assume that liability explicitly by contract. I mean, we've held when the state even makes an application in a bankruptcy case, it waives sovereign immunity and can be countersued on that claim.
The construction by the Maryland Attorney General, and as I understand, followed by the in Maryland, is that it isn't something that can waive. That in fact, you can't enter into this kind of indemnity agreement because it is ultra vires.
You don't have the authority to, but you can get the authority.
Which would require an amendment of the, at least statutory and perhaps a constitutional amendment to accomplish that.
No, the statute, you can always waive sovereign immunity, and you do it all the time.
This isn't just sovereign immunity, because this has to do with how the power is allocated among the agencies to commit to the expenditure of future funds. So the legislature has reserved to itself the authority, the exclusive authority to commit to the to the expenditure of appropriated funds. So it isn't just a matter of waiving sovereign immunity to appear in court. It actually has to go with how the sovereign, the legislature, has deemed it will spend its money.
I do agree that the appropriations is a problem because, the next legislature say it's really nice, but we can't afford it, and we're not going to waive our appropriate for a judgment. And I don't quite know the answer. I'm not sure the statute envisions that. But the statute does want a full assumption of responsibility, and the state is basically saying, you're asking us, telling us you can't do that because of state structural problems, and you want us to mandate an interpretation of the statute which would accommodate the state's needs. That's pretty activist within our part.
No, Your Honor, because
we could just read.
it isn't, and it goes back, and I recognize that you're not you don't see it my way, but I'll try to get there one more time, because what you're trying to preserve is state sovereign immunity, and the flip side of sovereign immunity in this case is forcing the sovereign to pay, and. In that case, the constitutional...
You have two levels. One is you have to be able to assume the responsibility, and you can't do that right now without authority. You as an agency, you need authority.
We can, to be clear, assume the responsibility subject to the availability of appropriated funds. I mean, it's sort of one... I understand that that's not a minor limitation.
I thought you could waive immunity to have the judgment entered, but the judgment couldn't be collected unless it's appropriated funds.
I may be
wrong on that.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. I think there should be an exception for states myself. I think these are good programs and...
I think that does go to the point because the statute does give discretion. The STB has exercised that discretion in exactly this context to preserve sovereign immunity in order to encourage and allow... participation by public.
Can we force them to exercise that discretion?
I think you can
say... I don't know if they have the discretion under the statute to ignore what the statute says.
Well,
but if they chose to do it, that's one thing. But for us to tell them they have to?
Well, and that there's two parts of our argument. Obviously, one part is that they're prohibited from excluding the sovereign, from requiring the sovereign waiver. But even apart from that, we do think that in light of Congress's expressed goals... of encouraging participation by public trail sponsors and private trail sponsors, and to establish trails, it is unreasonable and impermissible construction of the statute to refuse to give any consideration to the sovereign problems of public trail sponsors. And I think that this court does have the authority, clearly, to remand, to find that the decision is an improper interpretation and construction of the Trails Act, and to remand to the agency for consideration in light of the congressional goals.
The statute probably couldn't be clearer in this regard. It says, if a state, political subdivision, or qualified private organization is prepared to assume full responsibility, then we'll go, boop, 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 and you can go into this process. But that's a pretty strong statutory, this is at 1247D.
Yes, and at the top of that provision,
very first clause, before you get to the verb, if a state is prepared, and apparently the two states involved here are not prepared to do that.
Well, but prior to that, in the same provision, after the initial citations, that the Secretary, the Chairman of the Surface Transportation Board, in administering the Act, shall encourage state and local agencies and private entities to establish appropriate trails using the provisions of such program.
But can they violate Congress's mandate that they have to be prepared to assume full responsibility?
Congress's mandate does not preclude an exception for sovereign immunity, as the STB's construction of the Act, where they preserve sovereign immunity for claims against trail sponsors.
They made it a condition. They said, basically, if you're prepared to waive your sovereign immunity, you can have this.
But my point is that Congress didn't require that because the
1247D does.
But the STB has construed that same provision to preserve sovereign immunity for direct claims against the trail sponsor if the trail sponsor is a public entity. So STB's position now is we have the discretion to construe this to accommodate state sovereign immunity concerns. They've done it in other situations.
Why did they turn you down in this case?
Because they take the position that they have a ministerial duty that precludes them from giving any from accepting a swaffer other than the one set forth in their own regulations.
And our position. Why don't you sign one set forth in the regulations?
Because we're legally prohibited from doing so under our own statutes, because it would require an open-ended, unconditional indemnity that we cannot provide unless it's made subject.
So what happens if you sign it without the reservation?
It would be void ab initio and ultra virus.
Well, nobody said that yet. In other words, you just assume full responsibility and then let the legal course take its course down the road.
I suppose that's one approach, but really, where does that leave you?
It leaves you with a trail.
beg your pardon?
It gives you a trail.
But it doesn't, because the whole agreement is now null and void.
Nobody's declared it null and void. They didn't. And you haven't.
But we as a state agency cannot enter into a contract that we know to be null and void under our own laws, under our own procedures. Yeah. I think it's a much harder question. And the interesting thing is that, now take the other approach. You enter into this agreement subject to the limitation. Now, what are we talking about? That there's something happens on the trail that is not covered by the trail sponsor. That somehow someone comes up with a valid theory against MTA, the owner.
Two bicycles collide and somebody breaks a leg.
But first you have to find a direct theory against the trail sponsor, despite the owner.
If it's a private sponsor, it'd be no problem, right? Failure to maintain the trail. It's a big chuckle.
But what I'm saying is you still have to find a way to get a direct claim against MTA as the railroad, given that that the two trail sponsors have assumed full responsibility for the management and operation of the trail. Then MTA has to make a claim against the two.
Invitee comes onto the land. It's not a safe place. That's theory against the owner. And now the sponsor has to hold the owner liable.
My only point, and I'm not saying it's an impossibility, is that there's a series of hurdles you have to get to even get to the eventuality of making a claim against the trail sponsors that they choose not to honor, that the legislature choose not to fund. Is that circumstance any more remote or any more likely than the circumstance you posit where the trail sponsor is, where they don't live up to their obligation? The STB is willing to tolerate the example that you just gave and say, we'll sort it out later. And our position here is you should do the same thing here. Let us sign the agreement subject to the limitations, and if there's a problem in collecting the money, then you can deal with that at that time.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Light.
May it please the court, Eric Light, attorney with STB here on behalf of the board in the United States.
How come you guys are so rigid? It's a good thing.
Your Honor, what the board is trying to do is just do what basically Congress told it to do. And what Congress told it to do was...
Can a state ever become a sponsor?
States can, and they have.
What do they do to do it?
They sign a form that the board has set forth in its regulations. And we cited in our brief...
And what do they do about appropriations and sovereign immunity?
We don't know, Your Honor.
So if you can persuade them just to sign the form without the conditions... We're going to have a trail, and there's going to be no problem.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what will happen is the person who is injured on the trail will sue the state, and it'll be under the Tort Claims Act, and we'll get compensated. That ends it, right? The Maryland Tort Claims Act.
I'm sorry?
The Maryland Tort Claims Act.
Presumably they would sue under that and see what happens. I just wanted to address one issue that you had raised, which was whether or not a railroad can also be a trail sponsor. And I think it's true that Congress did not probably contemplate that sort of a situation, but if you look at the statutory language, it doesn't seem to preclude it.
It doesn't, but it addresses only a transfer.
Correct. It contemplates a transfer.
So it's got to be a transfer of something. So you may need to create a corporate entity, and if you do that, then you're going to have some cross-identifications or something.
Right. But I think the point is here that Congress legislated sort of with a general situation in mind where you have a trail sponsor and a railroad, a private railroad, and it did not necessarily contemplate that a state would be sort of standing in the shoes of a railroad. But in any event,
I did the hypothetical the next question would have been, we have two agencies of a state. Why isn't it the same? But I'm not sure the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad could become the sponsor on its own right of way. I mean, you may also have, now you may have questions with respect to the citizens who have residual rights to that right of way. And it seems to me Congress would have to envision, in the background of all of this, we still have fundamental real property rights at issue. In some cases, there may be an actual condemnation of the property. Others are easements, and if you abandon an easement, it's going to go back to the landholder. And I think what I'm hearing from Mr. Pilsk and what was in the briefs is that it's different depending on different places. And you just can't. The underlying real property questions are state issues, and the railroad right-of-ways were obtained through various mechanisms over the years in order to serve the transportation. But now Congress says, oh, we can make some trails, we'll use those right-of-ways, and there may be some takings issues still under this.
There are, Your Honor, and I think the courts have said that when Congress basically preempts the state reversionary law property interests, that can constitute a taking. And the courts have said that in some instances the federal government has been liable for those.
And it seems to me that background situation could inform how the statute's interpreted. I mean, if all of a sudden the statute's interpreted very broadly to permit all kinds of conversions and uses not contemplated by Congress, a landowner could very well say, hold it, you didn't strictly follow the statute, I want my property back.
Mm-hmm.
It's been abandoned, and you didn't follow with the statutory restrictions. Therefore, this comes back to me. We may be seeing a lot of shadows and ghosts, but I think overall the program is a nice program, and it seems to me somehow you two ought to be able to solve this because it's in the federal interest and in the state interest in this case. And what we're doing is we're looking at some language that creates problems.
Agreed,
Your Honor. I know you don't have the authority. You're arguing the lawyer for the agency, but that's...
Agreed, Your Honor. It is a good program, but it is governed by the statutory language. And in the Act, Congress did say that anyone who wants to be a trail sponsor has to agree to accept liability. And here the state agencies say, well, we'll agree to be liable, but then they add basically what amounts to a big maybe. And the board in this case said that anyone who wants to be a trail sponsor can't tack on a maybe to their agreement to indemnify. And the Trails Act is clear that maybe is not good enough. The board construed the act as requiring...
I'm not sure that the government isn't seeing, the Maryland and the Delaware governments aren't seeing problems where they don't exist. The governments enter into contracts every day, construction contracts, building roads and all these things. And in all those cases, they are subjecting themselves to the courts, why they couldn't subject themselves to the courts in this case. And they might choose to after this discussion today. He says no.
Well, That's true, they may, but if they don't, the point is that the board construed the act as requiring an unqualified agreement to either accept liability or to indemnify, and that was a reasonable construction of this language. In fact, it's hard to see how the board could have construed it otherwise. I mean, the act uses very broad, sweeping language, like full responsibility, any legal liability, and it requires the board to impose this as a condition with respect to any transfer of a rail right-of-way for interim trail use. But even if there were some wiggle room in the statute, the board's interpretation was certainly a permissible one. Remember, the Trails Act is a voluntary program, and so if the railroads don't agree to participate, there's not going to be any rail banking, and there's not going to be any trail. So Congress had to give the railroads some incentive to participate, and the incentive it chose was that they would be held harmless from any legal liability arising from interim trail use.
And that's the way it's written, but in this case, you have the state being the owner of the right-of-way, and the state says, we're satisfied, we don't need to be indemnified. This is an issue within our own walls, intramural discussion. And so that should, logically, that should carry a lot of weight, but I don't know how you handle that.
Well, we handle it by looking at the statute, and the statutory language doesn't contemplate this sort of specialized situation. As I was saying, it seems like Congress contemplated more of a situation where you have sort of a railroad on one side and a separate entity on the other side, not essentially two units of the same sovereign.
Well, I guess the answer to that is how they handle that between themselves has nothing to do with the language that the board is insisting on to govern the application of the statute, right?
I'm not sure I understand the point you're...
Well, you're insisting on form language, which you say is consistent with the statute. The board is entitled to deference on its application. And the Maryland council for the Maryland entity say, well, we've got this squabble, and we ought to be able to decide between ourselves how to resolve this issue of indemnity. Well, that's their problem. They can figure that out, but there's nothing to prevent them from signing the standard language.
Correct. And then I think the other point is that this is what Congress required, and that's what Congress put in the statute. It says that anyone who wants to be a trail sponsor has to accept full responsibility for any legal liability. It did not make an exception for the type of situation that Maryland finds itself in. Our position is that we have to follow the statute as it's written. And that's what the board has tried to do here.
Have you honored a sponsor that signed the form in the way Delaware and Maryland have signed it? Under any other circumstance?
Oh, in other cases, you mean?
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. There were, as I understand, there were two cases where this sort of similar type of language was submitted and the director of proceedings accepted this sort of language without any analysis. And there was no appeal to the board, and so the board never has passed on the propriety of that language before this case. There was one other case out of Florida where, again, similar qualifying language was included, and the director said, no, that's not okay. And again, that was not appealed to the board. So the case law, the board's case law, to the extent there was any, was conflicting. There was no settled practice, I guess I would say.
So you have at least two or three agreements that may be out of compliance with the statute that I suppose the director would have to go back and remedy, or just leave it as is?
Well, usually the board's practice, Your Honor, is once an agreement, once one of these trail conditions is imposed, that the board is basically in a reactive posture there. If someone comes to the board and says things aren't working out, they can file a petition to revoke the condition and the board will look at it. That's not happened here in those cases, and so the board hasn't...
In this situation, there's a lot of logic that favors the state. For instance, a person who is now injured on the right-of-way would have to sue the state because the state owns the right-of-way, right? And for failure to maintain the tracks or whatever the right-of-way. And the same defenses would come up now as would come up if a sponsor, the state were put in as a sponsor. So the public is not adversely affected by this agreement. And the taxes is the same issue. The state doesn't pay taxes to itself. and the sponsor wouldn't have to pay taxes to itself. So all the conditions that are being imposed by the statute and the reg under it don't make a lot of sense in this case and sort of frustrate a good effort. And I know the director turned his head on a couple, I guess, but he didn't on this one. I just wonder why they wouldn't just have an internal precedent. The other side of the coin is there could be an indemnity agreement signed by the state without conditions, and since they're suing each other, it's meaningless. They're not going to do it. But this is a strange case that's before us, and there isn't really, it's almost as if there's no foul. It's like no harm anywhere. We're just enforcing the language of a statute. But I guess the real person who's handicapped or isn't the judiciary. I mean, we have to enforce the statutes, and doesn't sound like it's the will of the people, whether it's state or federal people.
Well, I mean, that's the way the board saw this case. It is a strange case, but still the board has to apply this statutory language which is there.
And maybe you have it.
I'm sorry?
A couple of times did.
Oh, correct. But in this case, that's what the board was doing. And
I think we understand your position, unless you have anything further.
No, you know you
are. Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. White. Mr. Pilsk, what do we do now?
I realize you've been very indulgent with my time. I'm standing between everyone and lunch. I'll be very brief.
I think Mr. Light put his finger on one of the key problems, that this is a situation that is not contemplated in the statute or in the regulations or by the board. And what do they do in that situation? And here I think the fundamental error and the abuse of discretion is that they unthinkingly just pounded the rubber stamp down and didn't give it any thought, didn't consider how this situation plays out in light of the objectives of the statute, in light of the language of the statute, in light of their own practices, in light of the flexibility that they do have under the statute to accommodate sovereign immunities and sovereign concerns. And that's fundamentally the problem. They say they had a ministerial duty. When you look at the statute, they don't have a ministerial duty to determine the exact language of the SWAFR. And in their briefing, they essentially conceded that point and tried to limit.
I understand what you're asking us to do, though. They have taken an approach in reading the statute and doing their regs and approving these forms. It's not inconsistent with the statute. They're enforcing it to the T in a situation where the T doesn't fit the circumstances. And the question is, can we force them to take a different approach?
I believe you can, because their position in this case...
What's our standard? How do we do that?
Well, it's a traditional, arbitrary, capricious, and a reasonable construction of the statute. And one of the key standards is the construction consistent with the objectives of the statute?
You know, that helps in construing some ambiguous provisions, but the purpose of a statute. But we start with the language, and how do we handle the language?
Well, the language, I think, is ambiguous as applied in this situation. As I've said, and as the SDB concedes, they do have, there's nothing in the statute that mandates one way or the other, how they're going to deal with sovereign immunity.
What effect does the fact that they have gone ahead on two occasions in similar cases and allowed it to happen, what does that have on this?
I think that underscores that they have the flexibility to make the changes. They can take these factors into consideration, that they should construe the statute in a way that's consistent with the objectives to encourage participation by trail sponsors within the confines of the program, in order to create recreational trails and preserve railroad rights away.
Well, I suppose
what they've done here.
The counter to that is, though, that they've learned their lesson and they want to have an efficient method of administering this statute and don't want to have to delve into the nuances of parsing out every single exception and modification that each entity would like to make to the requirements of indemnity. Why is that not a reasonable way to administer the statute?
Well, at some point, and we certainly believe that that point has been crossed here, administrative efficiency and convenience can't trump the objectives of the statute and what Congress was trying to accomplish. They can't simply say, I'm sorry, trail sponsors, public trail sponsors, we can't accommodate you because We simply can't look at the intricacies of state law.
Well, but if the vast majority of sponsors are willing to comply with the requirements of the statute, of course, I'm not saying that that's the case now. We've got the government pointed to at least 10 entities in a footnote, maybe more, where the state entity had no issue, no problem with accommodating the requirements of the statute.
And my only response is these do. And we're at a situation where you're going to erect substantial barriers to participation by public trail sponsors, and there may be others. I mean, you threw out 10, that leaves 40, plus the District of Columbia. So, you know, there it isn't as simple as I'm just saying, well, 10 to 1, it's 50. And in order to say we're going to erect, and they've accepted it before, we know that there's at least two other entities that have the same problem. So this isn't an isolated incident. It is a unique situation, an unusual situation, and the STB should take the time and effort to think it through and come to a reasoned conclusion.
So you assume they have that discretion, and I'm not sure whether they do or not, but I feel that we're yet more constrained than they are because we have to start with the statute. And it doesn't look like they violated the statute. Now, maybe they did, but the statute seems to...
violated on two earlier occasions.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that the point is that they have the flexibility to determine what the violation is with respect to sovereign powers.
Maybe you have the discretion to just sign the agreements as is, recognizing that as a matter of law, they're subject to what you put in there, but it's implicit rather than explicit.
Well, they
would buy that.
They would. We don't believe we do. We may have to reconsider that, but... I think that the fundamental point, again, is should the court uphold a construction of the statute that leads to the results where public entities are discouraged from participating, in some cases maybe unable to participate, and the objectives of the statute are not met.
How do we address a statute that says you have to assume full responsibility for the payment of for any legal liability?
Well, first you can start...
responsibility for any legal liability. Now, that's pretty strong language. You want us to construe it except when the sponsor is a state or when the railroad's on the state or when we're talking about private. Yet it starts off, says, if any state is prepared to assume full responsibility.
And I think part of the question...
It means something, doesn't it?
It does mean something. And part of the question is, what is a legal liability? Is it a legal liability... if you have sovereign immunity against that liability, I would say no. And the STB, again, has recognized that it can exclude, that it can preserve sovereign immunity in some contexts. Why not here? Why not here when to refuse to do
but
so?
But if you can't waive it, you have it structurally. I understand the problem. I understand the debate. It's too bad. It's like those cases where you have a father and a son fighting over a business. It shouldn't be happening.
Well, I agree and just hope that your honors can step in and solve the fight in our favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pills. We'll adjourn.